The first reading this morning is a poem called simply Not. And it's by Joy Castro, who has written at length in prose about the difficulty she had leaving the religious culture of her youth, the Jehovah's Witnesses. This poem of hers is a reflection on her own story. In church, at home, they fall about my head and shoulders, pelting like hail, like spitballs, like stringing BBs, the various endless thou shalt nots, a welter of prohibitions, of things unclean or merely worldly, things forbidden to us. In my mother's voice, the preacher's voice, the voice of Paul or Moses, no, no. So, all right, I obey. My lips stuck shut with seen and not heard, glued tight by fear of the rod not spared. I shoulder the empty weight of all God wants me not to do. My sacred secrets, the arms tender melt when I carry my little brother, the chest's softening that comes with rain at dusk, the eyes following wonder at the shining, twirling, unnamed flecks of dust in a beam of light, dancing, falling gold. From dust I came, to dust will I return. That endless feeling, holy of holies. The grown-ups mention none of those. I keep them to myself. Not quite comprehending the genuine meaning of grace. And the second reading is the brilliant rhythmic poem, Not Enemies, by Stephen Levine. Some of you may know Stephen Levine as somebody who's written books on death and dying, but he has also been a poet.
We are not enemies, though parents told us so. We are not enemies, though they taught us so at school. We are not enemies just because the pulpit insists. We are not enemies, though strangers toss epithets. We are not enemies, though even love goes sour. We are not enemies just because we can't contain our pain. We are not enemies, though we meet short of our sameness. The best of each of us lives in the other. If we can forgive ourselves, we can forgive anyone.
Thank you.
American English, the language I'm speaking right now, is still a rather young language, at least when compared to languages like Hebrew or Latin. And it's a very fluid language. Most English words prove to be kind of sticky as they move through the world, picking up nuances and new dimensions of definition like burrs. And sometimes they even turn somersaults, so that over time they come to mean the exact opposite of what they originally meant. Like the word awful, for example, which used to mean full of wonder and awe. You could go into Chartres Cathedral and say, oh, how perfectly awful, and meant that it was beautiful. But now, of course, awful means something quite else indeed. Authority, this month's theme word, didn't lose its original meaning entirely, but it did pick up a few extra associations along the way these last 8 centuries. For example, when I came back from Calgary, Canada, a few weeks ago, I lost my passport. Someone may have picked my pocket, or I might have dropped it. I honest to God don't know. I have no idea. I simply had it in my hand, and then the next thing you know, I didn't have it in my hand. And it was very disturbing and very mysterious, but my hand was just empty. But I did know what I had to do. I had to report the missing passport to the authorities. I didn't even know who those authorities were in the Toronto airport. So I had to ask questions to find out. Eventually, I found out it was the U.S. Passport Authority, which had offices in Toronto. But at other times, the authorities that I have consulted have also been personal. Maybe a police officer, or a social work agency, or a specialist physician. In all of these cases, the word authority means a person or a group of persons. Yet that particular meaning of the word authority as a person or a group of persons dates only from the 19th century, around 1850. The earliest meaning of authority in English goes back to the 13th century, the era of the cruel Crusades. The spiritual radicals Francis of Assisi and Johannes Eckhart, and the founding of the great European cities like Amsterdam, for example. Back then, the word was pronounced autorite, coming from the Latin word auctor, which means author. But with a few other meanings fused to it, like opinion, advice, or influence. But the very first meaning of the word authority in English, back in the 13th century, had nothing to do with the Latin root at all, or any of these other accruing words, but rather it meant this, precisely. Authority is a book or a quotation that settles an argument. That's the first meaning. And this first meaning, 800 years old, is something that's still true for many people, despite all of the other additional meanings that are going along for the ride these days. For instance, you have all seen, I'd have to wager, someone holding up a sign at a sports event or some other crowded event with the words John 3:16 written upon it, just holding it up like that. This refers to a quotation from the Gospel of John, which has some words put on the lips of Jesus of Galilee. To the person holding up the sign, this quotation is an authority that settles something once and for all. You don't question such a passage, this person imagines. You just bow to it and accept it as the unvarnished truth. But I cannot think of any quote, any book, or any passage that I do not have an obligation to question if it's important enough for me to engage with it. I don't care if it comes from the Gospel of John, or from Shakespeare, or from Eleanor Roosevelt, Susan B. Anthony, bell hooks, Einstein, Adorno, or even the Constitution. No mere quotation settles anything. Quotations, you see, are all made up of words, and I have never found any reason in my life to think that some words are simply immune to questioning. After all, their very meanings may mean something entirely different to you than they do to me. As different, perhaps, as the word awful was in the 13th century compared to what it means today. Same word, different meanings. So unless I ask questions to clarify, I may have no real idea what those words could mean to you. And what's the point of accepting what you say if I simply don't get it? I don't see any point in that. My experiences are vastly different than yours. My hormones, my emotional ups and downs, my education, all different from yours. My family culture, my ethnic spin, my personal temperament, all different, as each of you are from each other. And I think that's perfectly okay that this is so. I think it's wonderful that this is so. It's how human life works. It's not a tragedy or some terrible inconvenience. It's an opportunity and a richness for which I am daily and hourly thankful. But this inherent and quite holy diversity also means that holding up signs with quotations that someone thinks settles something once and for all is just a big waste of time. Worse, it's just a ritualized form of self-congratulation. The John 3:16 quote simply means this to me. I, the person holding up this sign, know the truth. You probably don't. And if you don't accept my truth, it's fire forever, Buster. Well, sorry, that's simply not true. I don't have any reason to think that Jesus ever uttered those words, John 3:16. No scholar I've come to trust over the years thinks so. And even if Jesus did utter those words, I certainly don't think he would have meant anything close to what the enthusiast holding up the sign thinks they mean. Nor, just because they were uttered by Jesus, a man I much admire, are they necessarily authoritative. He was a human being, no less than you or I, given to errors and mistakes and misapprehensions. So why would I not question him too? But as I say, I don't think Jesus said any such thing as it's written in John 3:16 about God coming to save the world through insisting that Jesus be our primary and only focus of faith. Religious authority for me, you see, is not an assertion, a proposition. It's a conversation. And not just a conversation between you and me and someone else, but a conversation between me and myself as well. Which brings me to the readings this morning. Joy Castro was born into a Jehovah's Witness home. She was raised by people who claimed to have the final authority about every aspect of her behavior, all the things she should do and should not do. She experienced, she says, these authoritative quotations as BBs being fired at her, that annoying sensation, spitballs, another nice metaphor, as things that stung her, not deepened her. And she kept quiet about all that stinging, afraid of the rod not spared. You know the proverb, spare the rod, spoil the child, an evil proverb. But she kept these secrets from all those who told her what to do and what not to do. These secrets, these experiences that she had, were feelings, sensations that were not clear, hard-edged, precise quotations from a holy book. She writes, "My sacred secrets, the arms tender melt when I hold my little brother, the chest's softening that comes with rain at dusk, the eyes following wonder at the shining, twirling, unnamed flecks of dust in a beam of light, dancing, falling gold. From dust I came, to dust I return." Here she's quoting the scriptures. And then she writes, "That endless feeling, the Holy of Holies." The grown-ups, she adds, don't mention any of these things. And yet it was precisely those experiences which opened her to the light brightly dawning in her own spiritual new year, her own new day. It was those highly personal and transformative experiences of wonder and awe which she could not fit into the narrow range offered her by her strict religious upbringing, and which finally bid her to leave the unquestioning straitjacket of her religious life and to seek her own path. She came to trust the authority within her, not the authority pushed from outside of her, the authority of the grown-ups, which in her case, sad to say, was often accompanied with violence, the rod not spared. So she not only left her religion, she left her violent family. At what age? When she was 14. She had to get out to save her life. She now teaches at a university and is doing just fine. She found a deeper authority than quotation authority, something not reduced to words, something not even reducible to words, and I applaud her decision, as difficult as it must have been. Now listen to me, that was just the easy part. That's just the easy part. It's pretty easy for most people in this room, I think, to agree with. Leave the religious oppression behind. Go find your freedom. What many find harder is that some folks have the same secret experiences as Joy Castro. The glitter of falling dust, the beauty of dusk or sunrise, the tenderness of love. Same experiences, parallel experiences, if you will. And they don't give up their religion, and they don't give up their religious language. They don't sign up to the other orthodoxy, which states with self-reverential authority, "One day everyone will grow up, become mature, and will not need or want religion anymore. After all religion is evil. We can all be secular and find deep meaning in a world without religion." The end. I find absolutely no convincing reason to think anything like this scenario could ever happen. I know many people who have experienced their chest softening when it rains at dusk, who have wept as the pink dawn spreads across the east, who have seen the dust like so many stars flickering in a shaft of light, and have felt that deep momentary flash of infinity or unending wonder. And yet when they go to their Methodist church or their Jewish synagogue or their Muslim mosque, they bring that experience with them. And when they hear the ancient words holy or grace or God or Hashem or Haman or communion or prayer, they link them to the awe that trembles before them in the dust motes, that shivers in them before the rosy dawn or rainy dusk. I've seen the dust motes in a beam of sunlight myself. I remember one day in particular, I was in high school, and the afternoon sun angled down the long, high hallway windows. I was alone, walking through the sunlight, and I was aware of the radiance and the dust settling slowly in the light. The mystery of existence, the wonder that stars, like so many dust motes, exist at all. Yet, or the wonder that space drops infinitely deep under the floating earth and yet upholds all of us as well as 10 billion stars, hit me like a stone, or perhaps hit me like the great Methodist preacher John Wesley was hit. He said, I felt strangely warmed. I too kept my experience a secret and didn't talk about it. But I didn't think that this experience canceled all theology or anything I'd been taught about God and the holy. Instead, my theology was deepened by that experience, not blotted out by it. But then again, I was not raised in a fundamentalist church like Joy Castro, nor was I physically abused like she was by adults that she trusted. So it was a little easier for me to do. I'm not claiming any great event. And I know many other people do not suffer the worst religion has to offer and do not have to choose between secret experiences of wonder and public statements of the religious faith. They connect the two. Again, some will now speak with claimed authority and say, well, you know, experiences of wonder and awe are common, but they are not the same thing as some experience of God. Everyone knows that God is an all-powerful being, and dust motes are just dust motes. They are not related in the least. Well, I now question the authority of anyone who says that to anyone. It's an assertion with as little to underpin it as the assertion of John 3:16 by a true believer. If a man or a woman wants to associate their personal experiences of awe with what they mean by the word God, that's entirely up to them. They're not necessarily being foolish. I don't choose to do that myself. I'm not foolish either. But no one gets to tell anybody else what associations to make. I think of the poem by Stephen Levine, where people of all kinds, in his amazing list, parents, people in pulpits, schools, strangers tossing bad names, epithets is the word he uses, are all telling us that we're enemies. We're enemies to each other. Theists are enemies to agnostics and atheists. Christians and Jews and Muslims are all enemies. Color with color, enemies. Nation with nation, enemies. Feeling types with intellectual types, enemies. Conservatives with liberals, enemies. Artists and engineers, enemies, and so forth and so forth. I do not have to submit to those admonishments. It's a false authority. With Levine, I agree that they hold no authority over me. I don't have to be afraid. I don't have to see the world as packed with enemies out to get me, people with whom I cannot relate in any way. I can, however, accept the authority of my own experience with people distinct from me and recognize that different as we are, we also share a lot too, and that there is much more to forgive than there is to hate. Much more. I rather like the attitude reflected by Jesus in the Gospel of Luke toward authority, as in the story I told this morning. I don't decide, he says. You decide. You decide who your enemy is. You decide what your religious language is. You decide what you can comment on and what you can't comment on, what you have no business commenting on. None of these decisions are clear-cut, of course. They're not easy. It's not just simple yes or no. All of them have consequences, and you have to live with the consequences. But so what? Are any decisions outside of our religious life void of consequences? I can't think of any. No, you have to decide whether your experiences of awe are just that, or windows into something deeper than dust, something more holy. Or you can decide that the dust itself is holy. And so maybe in the end I can conclude that the deepest meaning of the word authority is not the 13th century one, some quotation or book that convinces me once and for all, nor even the modern meaning of the word that counsels me that authority means some person who controls passports. Maybe I can go instead past the original meaning in English all the way back to the original Latin word, auctor. Remember what that means, auctor? It means author. I am the author. What is authoritative to me? I am responsible for myself. I cannot dictate to anyone else that they are missing the boat, the one I'm on. I can only offer them my critical questions, and I have a right to do so. If they are willing to hear them, that is. If not, well, then I certainly don't have to engage in fruitless debates with people who think that John 3:16 answers everything. But I still have to make up my mind about what is indeed fruitful to my life. And I have to make up my mind how I'm going to live my life.